When we pray, it's the very first word that comes out of our mouth. Whether it's in public or in private, we bow our heads, we put the thoughts of this world out of our minds, we focus our attention on heaven, and we lift our hearts up to God and we say the word, Father. You think about it, it's rightfully so that we do that. Do you remember an occasion in Luke chapter 11 where Jesus had gone off by himself to pray? And he came back to his disciples and they said, Lord, teach us to pray. And he did so. But the way that Jesus taught them to pray was as a son would speak to his father. And in that occasion, he teaches them to pray. And in Luke chapter 11 in verse 2, he says, when you pray, say, Father. In another occasion, in Matthew chapter 6 in verse 9, we have another instance of where we have a recording of what we call the Lord's Prayer or the model prayer. And Jesus said, when you pray, pray like this, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. We read these things and we know that that's the way that we pray. It's happened several times just today that we go to God and we say, Father, we address him as Father. But is that something that we just say as filler? Is that something that's just the way that we pray? Or do we really realize what a privilege it is to do that? I imagine those disciples that were there in Luke chapter 11, as they were talking to Jesus, and Jesus came back and said, this is the way you pray. You start by saying, Father. Just the mix of excitement and puzzlement and joy that they would have to hear that. You know, as Jews, it wouldn't be a completely foreign idea to them that God was their Father. There are passages in the Old Testament that refer to God as the Father. But here was Jesus addressing God directly, personally, in a way that was foreign to anything really that we have recorded before Jesus, that he lifts his heart up to God and calls him Father. And in that crowd of disciples was the Apostle John. And John didn't write the book of 1 John until 60 or 70 years later. And although a lot of time had passed and many years had passed, that sense of wonder was never lost on John. Because as we read in 1 John chapter 3, in verse 1, John writes, see what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. There's a sense of wonder in the way that John writes that. Just this, see that we're called children of God, and so we are. Last time I spoke, if you remember, we talked about 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. And there's a description of God's people there. It says that you are a royal priesthood. And we talked about that. We broke that down. We talked about the fact that that's us. That's here. That's now. It's not something that we aspire to be, but we have responsibilities here and now. And we drew some parallels between the priesthood of the old covenant and the priesthood that we have in the new covenant. That we have responsibilities to be holy like the priest did. That we have responsibilities to know the law, to practice it, to teach it, to offer sacrifices. And we follow our high priest, Jesus Christ, as we are priests of the new covenant. And as I thought more about these things and I studied some more, it became really interesting to me to see when God tells us who we are. It's very interesting. I think it's something that we should pay attention to. And here we see a description of God's people. That's us. That's here. That's now. We are God's children. On the surface, it's something that is incredibly simple. It's something that we've heard throughout our lives. You look at our spiritual heritage purple cards. That's the whole theme of that, right? That we're God's family. We know that. We've heard it throughout our lives. It's incredibly simple on the surface, but it carries with it some profound implications for us in this life and for eternity. And as John says, it starts by seeing this kind of love, by seeing the love that the Father has given to us to give us the opportunity to be called his children. You know, in one sense, every human being is a child of God. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 6 refers to God as the Father of all. And in Acts chapter 17, we read about Paul going into the city of Athens. Remember, he spoke to the people in the Areopagus. And these people really didn't know who God was. They worshiped these idols. And what Paul says there is he quotes some of their poets, some of their philosophers. And there in Acts chapter 17, Paul acknowledges that all mankind is indeed his offspring. And it says that in him we live and move and have our being. And so ever since God breathed life into Adam on day six, everybody that's ever lived has owed their existence to God and has been his offspring. But when we speak of being God's children like John does in 1 John chapter 3, we're speaking of an incredibly personal relationship. Something that goes beyond the fact that we were just created by him, but that we have a spiritual relationship with him, and it's through Jesus Christ. That's what the Gospel of John talks about in John chapter 1. In John chapter 1, this is the kind of relationship that's described in verse 9 through 13. It says, "The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him, but to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." And so to all of us who have believed on the name of Jesus, who've accepted him into our lives, who are obedient to him, who follow him, we are God's children. Just like we talked about as the priesthood, or those who have been sprinkled with the blood of Jesus Christ, those of us who are Christians, we are God's children. And that's a special, special relationship. And it's amazing when we consider that at one time we were children, but children of an entirely different sort. What Ephesians chapter 2 says, that we were children of wrath. Ephesians 5 says that we were sons of disobedience, but now we're children and sons and daughters of God, a part of his royal family. And not only do we have the privilege to be called his sons, but because of what Jesus has done, we have the right to call him our Father. And this is God, who is all-powerful, who is almighty, who has existed before time, who will always exist, who created everything that there is. You think about somebody usually who is in such a high position of power, they're unapproachable. You know, we have a president in this country who has a great degree of power in this physical, earthly sense. I don't think that I'll ever get to just sit down and talk to him. But God, the Almighty, he's the one that we call in the most personal relationship that we can think of. And we call him our Father. And what a wonderful Father he is to us. Now, I'll tell you that I wanted to preach this sermon for a purpose, because I wanted to offer us some encouragement. And I wanted to remind everyone of something that should always give us strength and something that should always give us confidence in this life. There are a lot of members here who have suffered recently. There's been a lot of people who have gone through sicknesses and diseases and surgeries and tests and procedures and cancers. And you sit through the announcements and you hear all these things. You hear all these things that people are going through. There are several here whose parents have taken turns for the worse health-wise, and people have been met with responsibilities of taking care of them. And there's pain that comes with that. And there's suffering. There's sicknesses. There's heartaches. There's heartbreaks. And it's easy to get discouraged. And it's easy to get down. But what I want us to be reminded of is to remember that we have a Father in heaven who cares about us. That's what 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 7 tells us. It says, "Cast all your anxieties on him." Why? Because he cares for you. That's encouraging. And that tells me that there's nothing in this life that happens that goes beyond the realm of God's oversight. There's nothing that happens that God is not aware of. There's nothing that happens to us in this life that God doesn't know about. There's no little emotion. There's no little fear. There's no little stress. Whether it's something at school or at work, or you're concerned about your family, anything that goes on in your life that you're worried about, God knows about it. That's what Jesus taught. Remember in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 29, Jesus talked about the sparrows. The sparrow was one of the most just worthless, little insignificant animals. People would buy them, and if you bought one, sometimes they would just throw an extra one in because it was so insignificant. And in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 29, Jesus said, "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father." The implication, of course, is that if God is so mindful of the sparrows, then God knows what goes on in your life. And Jesus goes on to say in the next verse that he knows even the number of hairs that are numbered on your head. So when you're met with discouragement in life, God knows about it. And when you're met with stress in your life, God knows about it. And when you're worried, God knows about it and God cares about you because He's your Father. And because He's our Father and we are His children, He hears us when we cry out to Him. That's what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7. In Matthew chapter 7, verses 9 through 11. It says, "Or which one of you, if his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father, who is in heaven, give good things to those who ask him?" He cares. He sees us. He knows about us. And there's nothing that happens that he doesn't know about. Well, whether you know it or not, we've reached a point in this discussion where we have to address a tough question. And it's really a question that has cost many people their faith. It's a question that people don't know the answer to. And they say, all these things being considered, I don't see how it adds up. And the question boils down to this, at its most basic. Why does an infinitely good and powerful God allow terrible things to happen to good people? Have you ever thought about that? If all of this is true, if God is who we say He is, if He's everything that we believe Him to be, if He's all-powerful and all-loving, if He's both infinitely good and infinitely powerful, why do these terrible things happen? It can't be denied that terrible things happen. We look around us and we see injustices, we see wars, we see people that get hurt and injured. And so people look at September 11th, 2001 and say, where was God? Where was God when the planes flew into the towers? Where was God at the end of the Boston Marathon? Where was God when children are starving in third world countries? Where is God if He is all these things that we say that He is? And then we look, and it also gives us some trouble that we look, and it seems like there's people who are wicked, who go on throughout their lives, and they're greedy, and they're selfish, they're deceptive, and they prosper, and they just make more money. And then we look at some of the people who seem to be the most committed servants of God, those who are most dedicated, who are met with sorrow after sorrow and heartache after heartache. And it doesn't make sense to us. Where is our Father in times like that? Have you ever wondered that? You know, I think that if we have any compassion in our hearts, these are the concerns of the children of God. That we look at these things and we want to know the answers. And we ask these questions. But can I say that we look at these questions and we have these concerns by looking at the present circumstances? Right? That's the way it works. We look at the immediate. We look at the present. We look at those type of concerns, not understanding how these things can be good or how they can be right. But with God, He has the concerns of every human. Everybody who's ever lived, He has their concerns at heart, and He sees it with an eternal perspective. And that when we want to make a judgment on God, we can't do that because we simply don't see enough. And God sees it all. I think that's what God had in mind in Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. It's a passage that we quote fairly often. In Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, it says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." We can't understand why these things happen because we're just not equipped to see them. But there might not be any more comforting words than what God said to His people in a time of distress in Jeremiah chapter 29. Now, we know that Jeremiah 29, these are God's words to the Israelites. And it was a different time, and God had a different group of people, but God hasn't changed. The covenant has changed, and different things have changed, but God and His relationship with His people has not changed. And here are God's people in a time of distress in Jeremiah chapter 29. And He has some very comforting words for them in verse 11. It says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for wholeness and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." You know what God's saying in that passage? God is saying, I know how things look. Right? He's saying to them, I know how things look. And I know that you don't understand why these things happen. And I know that to you, from your perspective, you don't understand. But the great truth is that I do. God is saying, you might not understand. You might not see it. But I do. I know the plans that I have for you. And let me suggest that the same is true today. That when bad things happen, when injustices happen, when people are hurt, when people suffer, to us it might look like there's no way that it makes sense. This can't be good. This can't be right. And what God would say to us is that I know how things look. And I know that you might not be able to understand, but I do. That's our Father. You know, we don't have to read very far in the Bible to know that there will be pain and suffering in this life. It's actually Genesis chapter 3. We see that the curses that are pronounced on mankind because of Adam's sin, that there will be pain, there will be suffering, this life will have it. And I don't pretend to know all the answers for why these things happen. I don't pretend to know why there are injustices. I don't pretend to know why all these things happen. But what I do know is that nothing that happens happens outside of God's will or outside of God's knowledge. Would you agree with me that nothing that happens happens outside of God's will or outside of God's knowledge? And we get a little insight on all of this in Romans chapter 8. In Romans chapter 8, verses 20 and 21. It says, for the creation was subjected to futility, emptiness, vanity, not willingly but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And so we look at this world and we look at the things that happen and the frailties and the imperfections of it. And what Romans is telling us is that it was God that subjected the creation to that for a purpose. See, God allows these things to happen. God allows these things to happen to remind us that we have a dependence on Him. To turn our hearts to Him. To turn our hearts away from the passing pleasures of sin. To turn our hearts away from trusting in the physical things. To put focus and strength and dependence on Him. And to be jolted to the truth that there is something better than this life. When you think about it, really, sometimes mankind has to be jolted. If you look around and you look at the nature of man, man naturally strives to be self-reliant. He strives to put himself at the center of the universe. And what God reminds us through the nature of this earth is that that's simply not so. And so these things should turn our hearts towards a loving Father so that we can escape the bondage to decay, like this passage says. And that bondage to decay, I think it points out to the fact that everything in this earth is destined to decay. Everything in this earth is destined to pass away. There's nothing here that's worth putting our focus and our strength and our trust in. And when we look at that, God offers us a better way. And so in contrast to the bondage to decay, it says that we can obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And so here's a great implication that we have as God's children. If we are God's children, then we have an inheritance. We have a great inheritance that lies beyond this life. And we have a great hope ahead of us. That's what Romans chapter 8, verses 16 through 18 tell us. It says, the Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with Him in order that we may also be glorified with Him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Now, this is how the human mind normally works. If we're going to go and make a purchase, we make a list of pros and cons, right? You know, if we're going to have to make a big purchase or whether we're going to have to make a decision in life, whatever it is, we sit down and we think, hopefully, and we stop and we make a list and we consider our ways, right? This is what would be good if I did this. And here's what I would have to give up. And if I went this direction, then I'll have to give up this, but will it be worth it? And if you're like me, you can be very obsessive about these kind of decisions. And you talk to all your friends about it. And you wear out the people that are working with you. And you talk about it all day till they're sick of hearing about it. And then you call up your parents and you ask them about it. And then you talk to your significant other. And you sleep on it and you think about it and you stress about it. And finally you say, this is the right decision. This is the way I'm going to go. That's completely foreign to our decision to be children of God. Because what Paul is saying here is that it's not worth comparing. As far as Paul is concerned, there's no need to be concerned. In Paul's estimation, there's no need for estimation. It's cut and dry. There's no reason to think about it. There's no reason to stress about it. That the sufferings of this present time are not even worth compare to the glory that's laid up for us. And the inspiration and the motivation that we get from this, from what Paul's saying, is just magnified when we think about the sufferings that Paul went through. Remember, this was Paul who was beaten several times in different cities, who mobs would drag him out of houses at times, who was in several different prisons. He was in prison in Rome. He was in prison in Jerusalem, in Philippi. Paul, who was stoned to the point that they thought he was dead at Lystra. They dragged him out in the streets. And if you could ask Paul, was it worth it? Was all of that worth it? He'd look you in the eye and without hesitation say, absolutely. It's not even worth compare. At this point, we need to draw a distinction, though. Because we've talked about these terrible things, these sicknesses, these injustices, these tragedies that happen. And those things happen to everybody. But now what we're talking about is a specific thing that happened to God's people. That as children of God, we suffer persecution. As children of God, we suffer rejection from this world because of who we are. And this glory that's laid up for us, this promise of this inheritance, is only to those people who are willing to suffer persecution like Jesus did. And that's what we learn from 1 John chapter 3. If we look back at our text in 1 John chapter 3, remember it says, see what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. The very next line says, the reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. And so the point for us is that if we walk in the same way that Jesus walks, the world is going to reject us. They're not going to understand the decisions that we make. It's not going to make sense to them. Like 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4 says, the world is surprised when we don't join in the same flood of debauchery with them and they malign us. They're mystified when we don't want to submit to the same kinds of sins that they do, when we're not motivated by the same greed and selfishness that the world is, when we make stands for what we know is good and right, we stand out. And the example that we're given here in 1 John chapter 3 is that of Cain and Abel. Do you remember the story of Cain and Abel? Both of them offered sacrifices. And Abel offered a sacrifice that was pleasing to God. And Cain offered a sacrifice that was not pleasing to God. Abel never did anything to just like taunt Cain. He didn't go over to Cain and say, hey, look what I've done. You're wrong. We have no indication of that. Abel just went about his business. Abel did what he knew he needed to do. And you know what it did to Cain? It infuriated him. And we read in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 12. And it says, and why did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil and his brother's righteous. Do not be surprised, brothers, that the world hates you. I think this is the way that we find persecution most often. Is that the examples of the children of God will compel the children of the world to look at themselves and they might not like what they see. When we make stands for what is right, sometimes people are going to react negatively towards it. And so what I want us to understand is that we don't need to be surprised when that happens. We don't need to be caught off guard when the world rejects us because it rejected Jesus before us. And we need to make sure that we're not calling ourselves children of God and expecting the inheritance of this world. And that we're to be different because Jesus is different. So that draws me to the final point that I want to make from this. Is that as children of God, that we are striving to be like the only begotten Son of God. Our older brother, in a sense, Jesus Christ. And I love the way it's phrased here in 1 John chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. To see what kind of love the Father has given to us that we should be called children of God, and so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when He appears, we will be like Him, because we shall see Him as He is. And everyone who thus hopes in Him purifies himself as He is pure. You know, we consider different descriptions of God's people. We consider different ways that God tells us this is the role that you have. This is the responsibility that you have. And as we consider all those things, the resounding truth that comes back over and over, the truth that hammers into our lives, is that we can't continue living the way that we used to live. We can't live for ourselves anymore. It requires a radical change in our lives. And every discussion leads us back to Jesus. We talked about being priests. It led us back to Jesus as our high priest. And all the responsibilities that we have are things that He's perfected and things that we strive for. And as we strive to live out the responsibilities that come with being adopted sons and daughters of God, we look to God's only begotten Son, Jesus, and try to be like Him. Many of you know that a couple of weeks ago, me and Jordan went to Wisconsin on a soil judging trip. And you know, I see the little snickers and say, okay, we went to a soil judging trip. But it was a very involved trip. And every day we were outside, and it was cold and it was windy. And we had a great time. And one of the things that we did was me and Jordan got to share a hotel room, and we got to talk, and that was good. And we drew closer to each other. And one of those days when we were out and we were riding around from site to site, the whole group was really just kind of talking about our families and different things like that. And the professor that went with us asked Jordan about his brother, because Jordan mentioned that he had a brother. And he said, Jordan, what's your brother do? And some of you might have seen Jordan's brother this morning, and you'd understand why Jordan said, well, he doesn't do very much because he's nine. But so he asked him about that, and he said, okay, well, what's he want to do? What's he want to do when he grows up? And Jordan says, I don't know. Every time I go home, I ask him, what do you want to do when you grow up? And he says, I want to do what you do, Jordan. And Jordan says, well, what is it that I do? And he says, I don't know, but I want to do it. And we laugh and we smile because of the childlike innocence and the purity and just the respect that he has for his older brother. It's that same wonder that John writes with in 1 John chapter 3. He says, I don't know what it'll be like to be like Jesus, but I know that it's worth it. What we will be has not yet appeared, but we'll be like Him. And that's enough. Looking to Jesus, we don't know how it will be to be like Him. But we look to the begotten Son of God and aspire to mimic Him as the adopted sons and the adopted daughters. And as we look at our purpose in Romans chapter 8, verses 29 and 30, that's what it is. It says, for those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, in order that He might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom He predestined, He also called. And those whom He called, He also justified. And those whom He justified, He also glorified. God's family did not stop with Jesus. Jesus went first, but there are room for many brothers. And that's us. And let me suggest that this is something that happens a little bit at a time. You know, we read in 1 Corinthians 15, and it talks about the transformation of our bodies. And it talks about that in a twinkling, at the last trumpet, at the blink of an eye, that we'll be transformed. Right? We read about our bodies as being radically transformed, this mortal putting on immortality. But let's not confuse the physical transformation, the transformation of our bodies, with the transformation of our character. I don't think that it's our character that will be transformed in an instant. And that putting on the character of Jesus is something that happens a little bit by little bit every day. That we strive to be more like Him in love, in compassion, in a love for serving God. That every day we become more and more like Him. Like 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 18 talks about. That every day we're transformed from one degree of glory to another. That every day that we live, that we're a little bit more like Jesus and less like ourselves. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16 talks about our inner nature is being renewed day by day. And so when Jesus appears, we don't know what it'll be like. We don't know what we'll look like just yet, but we know that we'll be like Him. And the time to start becoming like Him as a child of God is now. I'll admit to you that there are certain passages, certain concepts in the Bible that intimidate me. Sermon on the Mount is one of them. I've always avoided teaching the Sermon on the Mount until it got thrust upon me in a men's study this semester. There's just so much there. The way that Jesus taught is so beautiful. And the more I read it, the more I get out of it. And I never really feel like I can do it justice. This is one of those topics that I challenged myself to talk about tonight. And I'll admit to you that right now, I feel like I haven't. I haven't even scratched the surface of what it means to be a child of God. But I hope it's something that has encouraged you. I hope it's something that's reminded you that you have a Father in heaven. It's something that reminds you of your purpose in this life. And when we read in the Bible and it tells us different descriptions of who we are as God's people, then that means something to us. And as John writes, God has called us to be His children. And so we are. We're going to pray again in just a few minutes. We're going to pray before we leave, and I hope that you pray several times on your own in the next few days. And you might bow your head, and you might focus your attention on heaven, and you might clear your mind of the thoughts of the world and address God as Father. And I hope that when you do that, that it's a staggering thought to consider the closeness that we're able to have with the Almighty. That the Creator of the universe is one that we can call in a loving, personal, submissive relationship. That we can draw near to Him as our Father. And I hope that when the storms of life are so dark that you don't see any way out, that when the stresses and the struggles give you such trouble, when sometimes you feel like quitting, that you won't, because you know that you have a Father in heaven who cares about you. And I hope that we're not surprised when the world rejects us, because it's rejected God's Son before us. And I hope that we're becoming more and more like Him every day to prepare ourselves for a weight of glory beyond all comparison. And as God's children, looking to that day when He'll welcome us with open arms, that one day as we're transformed every day to be like Jesus, that one day we'll see Him as our Father. He'll have His arms open and we'll get to go and live in His house forever. And the time to start being a child of God is now. I'll read 1 John 3, 1 through 3 one more time. And it connects all of these things that we've talked about. See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God, and so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared, but we know that when He appears, we will be like Him, because we shall see Him as He is. And everyone who thus hopes in Him purifies himself as He is pure. In just a moment, we're going to sing an invitation song. And I hope that you'll consider these things that we've talked about. That if you're not a child of God, like the Gospel of John talks about in John chapter 1, that you'll consider why you should be. And know that you might have come here this evening not being a child of God, but you can leave here knowing that you have a home prepared for you, knowing that He'll be with you in all of the things that happen to you in this life, that you can find redemption, that you can find an inheritance, that you can follow Jesus and you'll follow Him all the way to the throne of God. And so whether it's your first time here, whether you're a visitor, whether you come here all the time and you've been putting it off, you have an opportunity right now to become a child of God. And I hope that you won't leave here neglecting that responsibility or that opportunity. We're going to sing the song. We're going to stand at the front. And if you want to become a child of God tonight, you can do that. Come now while we stand and sing.